Marie Rohde, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
So you have been covering the Milwaukee Catholic sex abuse scandal since 1988, and here we are in 2015, and recently this year the movie Spotlight has come out, which has, you know, put a spotlight, so to speak, on the Boston Globe's reporting of their sex abuse scandal and how that initially came out, which did go on to lead a Pulitzer Prize in their series. But for yourself, how did you initially get involved in reporting the Milwaukee Catholic sex abuse scandal?
I was the journal's religion writer. When I took the assignment, it had traditionally been, with a couple exceptions, a job that was given to feature writers. And I came from a hard news background. I covered police news. I covered government. I covered courts. So some people thought I was crazy for becoming the religion writer, but I was interested in the topic. And it was at a time in my life I had children and, you know, why are we Catholic sort of thing. The Milwaukee Catholic Church was very important in this community. When I got the assignment, I was told to go meet the Archbishop of Milwaukee. And I did, and I found him to be an absolutely charming, delightful man. So that would have been probably 1981, 82, somewhere in that era. And I was very happy doing it. The first experience or the first time I heard about sexual abuse was sometime in the 1984, 85 era. There was a Louisiana priest who was accused of sex abuse. And that was the first case to get national notoriety. And my response was, oh, thank goodness it's not here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, anyway, so things went on. And then probably in the later 80s, maybe around 1988, there was a case involving a priest by the name of Dennis Pecor, who was a religious order priest who was a pastor at a parish on Milwaukee's northeast side. A young man in the congregation went to police and accused him of sex abuse. And what happened was that the priest stood up during Mass and said, I've been accused. I didn't do this. But if any of you think I should leave, please raise your hands. Of course, nobody did. Mm-hmm. And the kid was at that point working in a grocery store. And people would come in from the parish and say, why are you saying these terrible things about Father Dennis and so on and so on. And eventually what happened was he filed a civil lawsuit. It turned out that the principal of the school affiliated with this parish had written a letter to the archbishop several years before and said it had an array of complaints, everything from the kneelers, I think, to father is taking boys out of class to his apartment, and we think that is not a good practice. Archbishop Robert Weakland was head of the church here at that point. He sent a letter back to them that essentially said, if you continue making these slanderous remarks, we will turn it over to our lawyers. And the next year, the principal, and there was also a teacher who had signed, their contracts were not renewed. So then it went to a civil lawsuit, and there was an out-of-court settlement in it. The church said, we'd like to seal this record because we don't want it to cause any undue harm to the victim. And I had already done a story. I'd interviewed this victim who was very forthcoming about the whole situation. He was in court, and it was like a Perry Mason moment. He stood up and said, they're trying to protect themselves. They're not trying to protect me. And so they released the judge released the terms of the agreement, which was more than $500,000. So soon after that case, two or three other individual cases came forward and resulted in police charges. The big case, the first big case, was that of a guy named Bill Effinger. And Father Effinger had served in a number of parishes. And what happened, later it turned out he was a serial abuser, but Channel 12, I think it was, had gotten a tip on it, and they went with microphone in hand, ran into him and said, so-and-so says that, a victim says that you abused him as a child. And he admitted it on tape, which was kind of interesting. So anyway, There were a lot of parish hearings, and the archbishop was there. It later turned out that this man had abused more than 150 kids. The archdiocese knew about it for years. They said they tried to find treatment for him. They thought he could be treated, but time after time after time, they were learning of the abuse cases, but did nothing to warn potential victims or their families. And interestingly, in a deposition that was released as part of a lawsuit, Weakland said, "No, I did not notify people because they wouldn't accept him," which was kind of an interesting statement.
Yeah. And now that you mentioned, you know, the archdiocese have known about certain priests and their past with abuse, yet they get hopped around from parish to parish. And in a 1995 state Supreme Court decision, it ruled that the church could not be sued for negligence by victims of clergy sex abuse.
Right.
And for more than a decade, no new suits were filed. But then come 2007, the state high court ruled that if church leaders knew of an abusive priest and failed, as you said, to act and protect potential victims, the church could be sued for fraud, which kind of opened the door for, I think the number is 575 claims that
something like over 500
over 500 claims against the church here, or the archdiocese here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. With your personal experience in reporting this compared to that of the team of journalists depicted in Spotlight, you mentioned that you saw the film, and
yes,
this film is getting some good reviews, critical acclaim, coming up for Globe nominations, and it's really a team of actors. It's not necessarily anyone taking a lead role. So in your experience in reporting these stories, how did that compare to that of the Spotlight team of journalists and their research and their looking through the diocese records and their hunting down of victims, speaking to people? What was your experience in reporting here in Milwaukee?
Well, first of all, we had coverage on a couple different, as you mentioned, there was a gap after 1995. What happened, the negligence, it was thrown out, saying that the church could not be held responsible for not supervising its priests. That was just not. But later in 2007, what the court revisited the issue and said, well, yes, they might not be responsible for being negligent and supervising these guys, but if they knew about it, they can be sued for fraud. Now, that's very serious because you may know that in insurance cases, insurance does not cover fraudulent actions. So between 1995 and 2007, there were almost no cases. However, I had been working pretty much alone covering the story between 1988 or so and 1995, and it was a really difficult time. There was one thing did happen in 92 after there were several cases breaking. The archbishop wasn't talking to me and was not talking to the journal, and we got word that that some things were being said about how the journal was anti-Catholic and how I specifically was anti-Catholic. And so Sig Gisler, who was the editor at the time, contacted the archbishop and said, look, we want to, you know, smooth things over. And the archbishop said, I believe, said something to the effect, I'm not being treated fairly. And so Gisler said, well, if you would like to write your view of what's going on, we'll publish it unedited. And in it, there was one sentence saying about the victims, how they should be treated with concern and all that. But the rest of it went on to talk about how it was a press obsession to deal with these issues, and that Catholics in the pew were really having a negative attitude toward the press as a result of this, and that our priests need to be supported and comforted in this trying time. And so what was interesting, that ran on the top of the front page, and I was covering the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, as a matter of fact, that weekend in Washington, D.C., and Sig called me and said, Marie, a guy by the name of Peter Isley came in to see me, and was a very interesting fella, and he was talking about how he had been a high school student at St. Lawrence Seminary, and how he had been sexually abused, and it was sexual abuse at this high school boarding school was rampant. And he said, first of all, could you check this guy out and see if he's legit? And then if you feel like it, if you want to, why don't you look into this story? And so I said, oh, great, okay. So I went back and I found out that Isley had a master's degree from Harvard in religious studies, a theology degree, and that he was a therapist, had no police record, no other court record. He was the same legit, okay? And then I met with him, and so I said, well, can you help me find other victims if you say that they exist? And so we found about 30 of them. I mean, it was, like, amazing. And as I was putting together this story, the provincial got wind of it, and he said, well, when are you going to talk to us? And I wasn't quite ready. I wanted to know the scope of it. But eventually they came in, and we sat down, and I said, how many abusive priests do you know about? And I think I knew of 7, and they told me about 15. Hmm. And I thought, oh, my. So they knew about far more than I did, and they also knew about more victims. And so that launched that story, which ran on December 20th, 1992. And that was when it really took off. I got tons of calls and letters, and some of them were not nice. Some of them were frankly threatening. But for the most part, I was interested in the people who said, this happened to me. And I started looking into all these cases. But I was pretty much flying solo at that point. But SIG, I have to give him credit, because in a town that, like Milwaukee and Boston, where it's, and I think the editors in the movie talked about, are you crazy? You're taking on the church sort of thing.
Right.
SIG came in the Saturday before that story ran and personally edited line by line. Now, I don't know if you've been in a big newspaper. The editor-in-chief doesn't do that. But I think what was, and I didn't ask him why he did it, but I think that what was going on was that he knew that there was going to be a very dramatic response, especially coming so close to Christmas. He wanted to say, the buck stops here, in a very mm-hmm. visible way. And the other thing is that, unlike any other topic that the newspaper covers, religion affects us where we live. There are a lot of Catholics who feel very strongly about their faith, and the priest is there at all the times of joy and sorrow in a Catholic's life. And so there are very strong feelings. And as I may have mentioned, that the church is so much a part of the fabric of the community. They've done so many good things that people have a hard time believing that there could also be another side.
So as you mentioned, the ball really starts rolling, and if any of our listeners are familiar with the movie Spotlight, it's really at the end of the movie, when the first of the series is released, that the phones are ringing off the hook of people responding, of people coming forward saying, I've been abused. So what similarities do you see either in the way the Catholic Church is viewed in Milwaukee compared to Boston? What are the two cities' climates? Because as we know, they both have primary, large Catholic populations. And, you know, the city was founded on German and Polish Catholics. And
right.
Many people see all the churches just scattering the skyline here. If you go over the Hohen Bridge, you see
right.
steeples everywhere. So in your experience and opinion, what were some of the factors in these two cities?
Well, what I've read is that Boston was really the heart of the Catholic conservatives. Within the bishops, as well as among Catholics, among priests, there were so-called liberals and so-called conservatives. And Boston was a seat for that conservative movement, as I understand it. Milwaukee was considered by many to be a very liberal community. And Archbishop Rembert Weakland was a bishop here, and he was considered by many to be the leader of reform. One of the first things he did when he came to Milwaukee was that he invited all of the priests who had left the priesthood to a breakfast. And so that gave a lot of hope that there'd be a married priesthood soon. And then he spoke eloquently on women and their role in the church, and there was an expectation that there would be much more, that the role would be expanded. What's funny about it is that when it came down to the issue of sexual abuse, they responded identically. They blamed victims often, or they ignored them. They blamed the press. In Boston, you know, famously, it was reported that the cardinal law brought down the wrath of God on the Boston Globe for doing all this reporting. Now, whether that's true or not, I'm not sure. And also, when they were alerted to the fact that there was an abusive priest, they didn't remove him from the ministry. They, if they did, they sent him for treatment, perhaps. But for the most part, what they did was moved from parish to parish.
Right, probably listed as sick leave or absence,
right,
or
right,
the things that we saw in the diocese records.
Well, that was, it was kind of funny that the Boston Globe kind of tripped across something in the Catholic directory. And we, too, had in our library, we had all these books. And I'd hear about Father so-and-so, and I'd go back to see, well, where did he serve? And exactly the same thing jumped out at me. A sick leave, never serving more than a couple years at a parish. It was very similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big difference was that I was pretty much working alone. I did have, I'd say, support at that time.
Yeah, a large endeavor. And as you mentioned, with the response of the church blaming victims or discrediting media,
right,
you wrote in one of your articles that the Archdiocese dismissed some cases, particularly this is during the bankruptcy, claiming victims, that their claims were invalid because if they were a first victim of a priest or supposed first victim, they could not have known he was an abuser. So therefore, it doesn't have any legal claim, which is, you know, it's just so surprising, you know, to make a probably blunt analogy. Maybe a dog owner doesn't know they're going to bite someone.
Right.
But that doesn't make them any less responsible, you know.
Well, you'd think, but...
You'd think, but they
yeah,
seem to get all these loopholes around,
right,
either, well, in the state court or just...
What was funny about that was they were applying a state court ruling which had been put on hold during the bankruptcy proceeding. And so the state court had said you can sue for negligence if you can prove that there was that they knew about it, and they were saying, well, no, we didn't know about it, so we couldn't. But it was confusing the two laws, I think. But the other thing that's important here is that in a lot of the other cases, I'm doing a story right now regarding another diocese in the country, and what the bishop there said, I accept all of these claims as true, and I submit them to an independent arbitrator to decide if they are true, or if and how much compensation they will receive. And here, that didn't happen. It was the archdiocese went through and decided what claims should be in what, which category, who had a claim, and there were a whole bunch of claims that were dismissed, and they went to court and had them dismissed, but that was part of what was going on. The victims say that should not be for them to decide. It should be decided by a neutral party, but that was the way that it went.
And you also note in some of your reporting that the Archdiocese consistently said that while they don't doubt the allegations made by victims, none of the claims are legally valid, whether due to,
right,
statute of limitations,
right,
or,
right,
the first abuse rule, or, you know, some of,
right,
these other things that seems to hop and skip around responsibility. So when this started to pick up again, in February of 2008, documents released stating 4 decades of cover-up in connection to a priest who was in Wisconsin but moved to California, was being filed against in California, which opened up all of these other documents. And before that, money of approximately $57 million was moved into a cemetery maintenance fund. And Archbishop Timothy Dolan at the time, he's now a Cardinal of New York, requested this to the Vatican in June of 2007, and this motion was approved July 18th of 2007.
Very quickly.
Very quickly compared to the years.
Especially
for the Church and Vatican compared to the years some of these victims have been fighting claims in court. And as we know, Dolan left Milwaukee in 2009, and as you mentioned, over 500 claims of abuse have been filed in court. So with all these interesting loopholes, the statement by the Archdiocese, you know, what have you uncovered that has most surprised you? I mean, all of this is, of course, shocking, but...
Well, one of the things that surprised me was, all right, when we're talking about this $57 million trust fund that was established, and the Archdiocese, rightly or wrongly, argued, well, that money was always there for... It was in the general fund, but it was always intended for the use. But there were no real documents outlining how that they arrived at that figure. And then the letter that Dolan sent to Rome and so on, it didn't pass the smell test. He may have been correct and just misspoke in his letter. I don't know. But what happened there was it was ruled, eventually appeals court said that $57 million should be part of the estate, meaning that it should be fair game for any of the creditors to take. The Archdiocese at first was appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court, and what happened there is, I hope I'm recalling this correctly, that before a decision was made whether they would accept that case, they entered into this last-ditch final effort at negotiating. So we will never know whether the $57 million was fraudulently transferred. Now, fraud is a criminal term. But I think a lot of people, if they remember that, it really kind of affects their trust in the bankruptcy system. I think that the question was never answered. Was there fraud or was there not? And if there was fraud, why did they get away with it? And now some of the money, they did transfer some money in the form of loans or whatever from the cemetery trust fund into the bankruptcy estate as part of the settlement. But the other thing that was the Milwaukee, there have been 15 or so dioceses that have filed for bankruptcy. Milwaukee's went on for almost five years. So that kind of leads to, did it have to be this way? The Archdiocese disputes how much was spent on the legal fees, but it looks pretty clear that it was close to $30 million,
And
much more than the victims received.
Yes, and to break down a little bit where we stand now, basically, with an August article, it states Milwaukee's Archdiocese settlement plan stuns sex abuse victims. And you mentioned most of their money is going towards legal fees, and the settlement for victims has been the smallest compared to other cases in the country, and it even has to be distributed amongst them. And I believe over 200 don't even get anything,
right.
And that's in addition to
right.
The state lawyers have worked over 20 years on right. These cases. So where are we now in these abuse claims and the bankruptcy filing?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can't. The bankruptcy lawsuit is over. It's closed. It's done. But your point about how much money, all right, it was like $21 million that would be shared by hundreds of victims. That is compared to a California case where two priests from Milwaukee that were moved out to California after being accused of abuse here, they got out of town quick, and they continued their abuse out there. Well, the Archdiocese had to pay something like $17 million toward settling, though I think there were eight victims in that lawsuit. And here, there were 535 or something, not all of whom got any compensation at all, but maybe 300 or 400 got some compensation. And they got $21 million. And so, yeah, that's just side-by-side parallel. But one of the other things that's going on here right now is that back in 2002. The journal, as I said, and we wrote stories till 95. The law changed. All the lawsuits were dropped. So there wasn't a whole lot to write about. But then by 2002, when the Boston Globe was doing it, that was when the journal formed a team. And there were, I can't even remember how many of us were writing on it at that point. But also, one thing that did happen was that the legislature passed a mandatory reporting law, which you'd think, wow, that is really great. But what they did was that they included a phrase that excluded anything learned during pastoral communications. That's still on the books. And so the impact of that, I think, is that, well, first of all, pastors or any religious official who learns of any abuse can claim, I don't have to report that because it was part of a pastoral communication. And that also would prevent them from any fraud lawsuits if that should ever come forward in the future. So I think the victims are in a much worse position now than ever before. And not just because of the relatively small settlement, because many of them say this wasn't about money. You know, people often say to me, when is this going to end? And while the victims want, what I've heard most often is that they want truth before they can have reconciliation. And the truth, it was thwarted by the filing of the bankruptcy. Those lawsuits never went to state court because of the bankruptcy. The claims against the church were all sealed, so that's never going to come out. And by the way, a lawyer for the victims claimed that there were 100 priests named in those files that were never made public. So, and the archdiocese, of course, denies that. But
I was only able to find 45 public names.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there were all these other names. They were saying that in addition to that 45, that there were 100 that had not been named.
Okay.
Now, I think that that's a major problem unless that law is changed. There is no requirement that they have to report. Now, they say they do. They say they do, that they report. But, you know, I'm not sure.
And with the winners and losers in the Milwaukee Archdiocese bankruptcy settlement, you state, as you mentioned, the victims are in a worse situation compared to when they started. But bankruptcy lawyers, both representing archdiocese and the creditors, receive about $20 million. Another $4.5 million goes to the lawyers involved in the cemetery trust litigation. And each of the parishes have been asked to contribute $2,000 to a therapy fund for abuse victims, which I believe the Archdiocese said, whether the cases were dismissed or carried forward, they all get therapy funding and treatment. And, you know, the Archdiocese now has a fresh start without debt, and it sold no property to reach the settlement. You know, it's remained largely intact. And as you mentioned, you know, who are, besides the victims in their situations, you know, who loses, you know, right now?
Well, I think we all lose, really.
Yeah.
But one of the things, this is such a minor point, but it really stunned me, was that once the Archdiocese filed for bankruptcy, they didn't pay their electric bills or their water bills. And so that amounted, I don't know, to combine to about $150,000 or $160,000. And that's passed on to everybody who has water, electricity, gas. And so probably a fraction of a cent for each of us. But still.
Or even, as you mentioned, contractors, office suppliers, vendors.
Yeah, they all lost. But also I think that the church has lost in as a result of this scandal. One of the things, there was a Catholic university that did a study, and they talked to only Catholics, and three-quarters of those Catholics who were interviewed said that they thought the bishops had lost, or the church in general, had lost its moral authority, that they would no longer be listened to in the same way when they were talking about social and moral issues. Interestingly, even two-thirds of the people who attended Mass regularly said that was the case. We've seen a great decline. Pew Center released a study that the Catholic Church is losing members faster than any other denomination in America. There was a dramatic decrease in the number of Catholic weddings. One of the things that very visual for me was, I remember that this year on Good Friday, I was making dinner and I had the TV on. And one of the TV stations had gone to the cathedral and had a picture of Good Friday at the cathedral. And I looked at it, I was stunned. There were like 10 people there. And I remember back in the day when I had to do Good Friday stories and I'd go to the cathedral and it would be packed. You couldn't find a seat unless you got there 45 minutes early.
Right.
But I suspect that it's having a profound effect in the pew. It's having a profound effect in families. And I don't know where it's going to end because it's not over yet. This has become a worldwide story. The abuse was horrible. But what was even more horrible and what has never been addressed was their role in it. And until that can happen, it's not going to end.
Were you a Catholic at the time before really getting into this? So what was your experience first uncovering this as a Catholic and then moving forward and reporting the story over the years and, as you now say, no longer a Catholic?
I guess I was really stunned. The church has done so much good, and I had such tremendous respect for all that good that was done. It was heartbreaking, and it continues to be heartbreaking.
As a freelance journalist, and with your experience in the Sentinel and various other media groups, we see a unfortunate decrease in investigative journalism being phased out, underfunded. We have yet to see what the repercussions of the Gannett Media purchase of the Sentinel will be. What do you think the future is for series such as the coverage of the sex abuse scandals in the church? Are you still hopeful as a journalist, or do you find more freedom?
I'm very hopeful. The Journal Sentinel has done some outstanding investigative reports, but interestingly, right now they don't have a religion writer. But the Journal has been covering a lot of, they covered mental health issues, they've covered the Great Lakes, they just won another award for the Great Lakes studies. This is different, I think. It's a harder story to cover because it hits people where they live. And not just for the people who have been abused, it also hits just people in the pews because it raises doubt, I think. And there were journalists who are Catholic and devout Catholics, and they had to think long and hard about this. It had an impact, and I think every individual is impacted differently.
And with Pope Francis, he's been making a lot of changes with his leadership, and what do you think his impact is on, A, the response of sex abuse scandal, and B, his impact when it comes to trickling down to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Boston, Massachusetts, or just the U.S. in general, any place outside of the Vatican?
That's interesting. He's talked about making a lot of changes. He's formed committees and councils, or whatever they're called, to look into these matters. But there haven't been any real changes. And I think I know some women who are very much wanting to see women ordained. He's pretty much made that clear that's not going to happen. But he's got his hands full. Apparently, there was a great deal of corruption within, the Vatican itself. And so he's trying to deal with that. And will he succeed? And if he does not, who knows? But he hasn't really addressed this issue in any meaningful way.
So do you think he needs to address it more publicly, or do you think the change needs to come on a more local level?
I think if he made a very strong statement, not saying my heart goes out to the victims, which every bishop has done, what needs to be done right now is for them to confess their sins, to talk about their role in it, why they acted the way they did. Get behind a law that would be a meaningful law for reporting if they find out that a priest is abusing children. I don't think that's a system that gives public faith that the right thing is being done.
Well, I trust if anything changes, you, of course, will be there to report it. And I'd like to thank you for all the work you've done over the years and continue to do, and
thank
for coming
you
in to tell this story today.
Thank you.